Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Okay, guys, Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org, libertarianinstitute.org, and follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show, and check out the questions and answers stuff, and you can ask me some at scotthorton.org/show, if you want to do that. Okay, introducing Andrew Coburn. He's the author of Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, which you guys really should read, and also Kill Chain, and I'm sorry I don't have the subtitle in front of me. The Rise of America's High-Tech Assassins, something very close to that. And he is the Washington editor, I think, of Harper's Magazine. The great Andrew Coburn, the great Patrick Coburn's brother. How do you like that, too? Welcome back, Andrew. How are you, sir?
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you, as always.
Yes, sir. Very happy to have you here. Now, we already talked about this article before, but I'm happy to talk about it with you again because I think it's so important. And, of course, the audience is new and changing all the time. And I think people are now maybe newly again interested in this. The politics of last fall are over and all that kind of thing. So now we can get back to who's killing who here. So the article is in Harper's. It's free at harpers.org. You don't have to register anything. They'll give it to you. Harper's.org. Acceptable losses. Aiding and abetting the Saudi slaughter in Yemen. So I guess maybe I'll ask you who's who and you can divide it by north, south, and center, or by whatever political faction you want, or take it from here and say what you want.
Okay, well, let's take a whack at it. It's complicated. Basically, what you have in Yemen is a war, a civil war to a certain extent, between a group, the Houthis, who are this group from the north, sort of far north of the country, close to the Saudi border, who are allied with people loyal to a former president, Saleh. And they're important because that Saleh's support came from the army, who he'd been paying off for years. So it's Houthis plus basically the Yemeni army. And they are fighting with forces allied to a guy that the Americans and the Saudis basically put in, who was kind of a hopeless, unimpressive general who never thought anything much of, called Hadi. And what's important about him is he has the support of the Saudis. And to that end, as you know, most people probably know by now, the Saudis, in support of Hadi, who was kicked out by the Houthis, a lot of H words here, in March of, February 2015, the Saudis intervened to put him back in power and to whack the Houthis, who they accused of being allied with Iran. And to that end, they've been waging this completely horrifying, genocidal, disgusting air war ever since. Two further points on that is that there's not really much evidence that the Houthis are supportive. I mean, they're, get rhetorical support from Iran, and they've had, as I've informed, they've had a few sort of weapons shipments, but nothing very significant. They're still basically living off all the stockpiles that the Yemeni army built up over the years when Mr. Saleh was in charge. Okay, second point is that, again, as most, just to remind people, the Saudis, in turn, are supported by the United States, who is very happily, the arms manufacturers here, the Pentagon and all those interested parties, have been lining their pockets, their corporate pockets, with immense profits due to their enormous arms sales to Saudi Arabia, who need the planes and the bombs and the missiles and the cluster bombs and even the gasoline, which we're also supplying with our tankers, to keep this war going. And the U.S. has been making and doing very well out of it. They've sold, I think it's kind of out of date by now, but it's the one that sticks in my memory. As of really the summer of last year, they had already sold $115 billion worth of arms to and munitions and war-making stuff to Saudi Arabia since 2010. On the other, meanwhile, at the same time, you've had for years, based in Yemen, a small contingent of Al-Qaeda, who were in one way or another covertly supported by, with funds and support from within Saudi Arabia, elements of the Saudi government, who gave protection to important Al-Qaeda figures and who indeed set up an important base for jihadis, who basically became Al-Qaeda, in the middle of Houthi territory, was what helped start all this business in the first place. So the Al-Qaeda, at least theoretically, is the enemy of the United States. I'm not theoretically, in fact. And the U.S. intelligence agencies, particularly CIA and the sort of covert branch of the U.S. military, the Special Forces, Joint Special Operations Command, SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force and all that, have been waging their own little war against Al-Qaeda in Yemen using drones. Just to confuse people a little further, I should point out that Al-Qaeda in Yemen has been basically fighting against the Houthis and in support of Mr. Hadi. So, as you just mentioned briefly, we are fighting, in effect, on both sides. We are, we're supplying all the stuff to attack the Houthis, the Saudis, and making money out of that. And at the same time, we are attacking the Al-Qaeda people who are the enemies of the Houthis. So, this is logical, I guess, to the Pentagon and to the CIA. But certainly not to me, and I should think not to most Americans, that we should be intervening on both sides. Yemen is in the news, should be in the news all the time, but shamefully it isn't, because this war that we've been, in effect a part of, has reduced what was already a very poor country to starvation. I mean, people are starving to death because, the Saudi bombing has destroyed most of the infrastructure, all the bridges and factories and power plants and so forth. And at the same time, we are assisting in the blockading and destruction of the Yemeni ports that the Houthis, which dominate, most of the country, were getting food in through. So there's millions and millions and millions of Yemenis, and particularly Yemeni children, that either have starved to death, are starving to death, or will starve to death, thanks to us and our Saudi friends. So, but nevertheless, what are we hearing about in the news today is our attack on Al-Qaeda. And if you didn't notice, on January 29th, in the course of a pleasant dinner with the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Mattis, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and his daughter and son-in-law, as he sort of wiped his mouth with his napkin, gave the go-ahead for his first big covert raid of his presidency, which was to attack this, alleged Al-Qaeda figures in the middle of Yemen. And it was a total bloody fiasco, as I hope people realize, killed at least 25 civilians, at least. And we have their names and their ages and their genders, because nine were women, one of them heavily pregnant, eight were children, the youngest being 3 months old, aging from 3 months to 13. A lot of the people killed in the course of the raid, armed helicopters overhead just sprayed the village with machine gun fire. There's an excellent report on this in The Intercept by Iona Craig. I urge everyone to look that up. Mm-hmm. And as we know, it, you know, didn't look too good because, you know, one of the attackers on the ground, a SEAL member of SEAL Team 6, was killed. Three others badly wounded. Well, they say a $75 million, actually a $100 million Osprey. It's a kind of helicopter, cross between a helicopter and a plane, crash landed and had to be deliberately destroyed. So it was a pretty expensive business, and that's a $100 million plane. And they claimed, of course, you know, the White House and the military claim it was a huge, well, the White House certainly claims it was a huge success, and they got lots of valuable intelligence and laptops and cell phones, which is hard to understand because they destroyed the village. So I'm not sure after they'd blown it up with missiles and machine guns and cannon, how they managed to find any intact laptops in there. Seems unlikely. Since the military, of course, is busily covering up what a fiasco it is, General Votel, who is head of Central Command, but used to be commander of JSOC, so he has a sort of professional interest in this kind of thing, his old outfit. He basically said no one did anything wrong. It was all well planned. You know, accidents will happen. And he puts the maximum number of civilians they killed at 12, between 4 and 12, which is just a tremendous lie on his part. I mean, people have been there, people have done, you know, careful investigation, including Iona Craig, but also the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London. And, you know, they've, you know, who produced the names of the people, the men, women and children they killed. I mean, I said the women and children I mentioned, I mean, some of the men were, there was a couple of guys who were in their 80s they managed to kill. They managed to kill some people who'd come, there were Al-Qaeda in the village, certainly. They managed to kill some people who'd come to the village to ask Al-Qaeda to release their relative. I mean, they were not Al-Qaeda people. And by the way, the poor village, this had been shelled a few days earlier by the Houthis. You know, just shows what a mess it is and how, what clowns the government, the, you know, Washington is to sort of insist this was all a good idea. So that's about it. Anything you think I should add before I run completely out of breath?
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty good start, man. I got some follow-up questions for you here. I mean, first of all, I guess we could point out about the narrative of this botched raid is that it was botched because a SEAL died. And so the argument is reduced to that is absolutely unacceptable that a special forces soldier, operator, would ever lose their life in combat. And damn incompetent Trump. But then the argument to that is, hey, come on, man, it's a war. And you know what? He got shot. I mean, there was a firefight. These things happen. You know, it can't always be 100-0 in every skirmish. And so in this case, we lost one guy. And then that's the end of the argument. There is no argument about, well, yeah, but what about the 80-year-old man? And what about all the women and children? And the one that jumped out to me in the Intercept piece was the woman running with the baby in her arms who got her head blown off, just like Vicky Weaver, right? Just like George Bush Sr. did to Vicky Weaver, that caused the whole, you know, massive Ruby Ridge scandal there. The baby in her arms, Lon Horiuchi, the sniper, and all that. That's what our foreign policy is. Ruby Ridge all day long. Killing women, killing children, killing grandfathers. Like, what is this? We're supposed to just go, well, you know, I don't know. Did you hear that a SEAL died? Oh, what a tragedy. And yeah, just forget them.
I know. I'm sorry for the SEAL. I'm sorry for his wife and all the rest. But, I mean, you know, this was all, if you noticed.
Yeah, but hey, at least he's a combatant. So That's part of the game. I'm not gloating about it either. I'm not saying it's great or, you know, anything. I'm sorry about it. And he's got a family and all these things, too, just like you say. But it's just, hey, you know, he signed up to play this game. The people, most of, seems like everybody else who died in it just happened to be a bystander.
Yeah. I heard Trump's speech. I happened to be in the Congress when he talked to the Congress the other night, and you know, he made his, you know, this kind of cheap trick that they all do. I mean, Obama did it. Reagan started it, I think, of invoking some poor fellow who'd been shot on their watch, you know, thanks to orders they'd given.
Right.
And the whole, you know, they all rose and clapped and clapped and clapped and clapped. But he never mentioned where this guy had been killed. Trump didn't. He never said, you know, Trump killed Owens killed in a firefight in Yemen. It was all like, you know, it wasn't even worth mentioning. Who cares where we are? You know, we just have to worship this fellow and, you know, an American hero. And as you know, no mention of the circumstances of naturally he wasn't going to talk about the children they'd killed or anything like that. And, you know, clearly no one, I know a few congressmen, but not many. You know, there's a few of them who care about Yemen, but very few. I didn't notice any of them refusing to stand up, I must say. So, yeah, it's, you know, this ongoing Yemeni war crime is so very, very upsetting that, you know, no one really gives a damn.
Wasn't mentioned, I don't think, at all during the campaign. And that's the thing about it. It's, I mean, the genocide itself is pretty bad. But it just seems so unfair that people don't even have to know about it, you know?
Right. There were six stray. I did a search on all the debates. And Yemen got mentioned six times. Now, not discussed. It wasn't discussed at all, but they was in, you know, they'd say, someone would say, at various times, oh, you know, Iranians, you know, taking over Yemen, or be some ignorant statement by one of the candidates. That was it, you know. And there's this war, which, you know, given the people we've starved to death, is, you know, the most bloody war ongoing, I'd say. You know, maybe the Congo, or you might find another one, but it's certainly high on the list. And no one cares. And, you know, the Congress isn't going to investigate, you know, what actually happened. There's going to be, you know, there should be hearings. People, you know, it's an outrage that this casual raid, you know, sort of fixed up by Trump over dinner. They go in and then they tell, you know, it's a fiasco. And then they proceed to tell lies about it unchallenged.
Yeah. Well, see, I think
just say one more thing.
Sure.
We have this very terrific piece of investigation by The Intercept, by Iona Craig. We have, and then there was a similar sort of on the spot investigation authorized conducted on behalf of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London. That's it. You know, the New York Times hasn't bothered to send anyone, the Washington Post, you know, none of the big, you know, fat, rich media has bothered, you know, thought it worth following up. Certainly not.
Yeah. Yeah, now, so to get back to the level of war crimes here that, you know, beyond the wars themselves, the two different wars that you've talked about, really more than anything else, it's the economic war, reminiscent of what Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton did to Iraq in the 1990s, and which you've also written really great stuff about. By the way, everybody, Andrew Coburn, Iraq sanctions, Google that, man. That's the thing of it. As you mentioned, the attacking of the port, and then I'm not sure if you mentioned or not, I get it all scrambled up, but importantly also the closing down of the central bank and moving it from the capital of Sana'a down to Aden, and that means that basically no one up in the north can do any kind of international monetary transfers whatsoever. And so... And this is
right.
It's the kind of thing that sounds like some technical point in some business journal or something, but no, in fact, this is key to everything here. It's shutting down that bank means everybody in the north is what? There's no more Safeway.
Well, I mean, the bank, for example, I mean, we probably talked about this, but the bank was, you know, paying, was using its, you know, was being quite well managed and was paying the civil service. Now, there was like 1.5 million civil servants who were getting salaries, and they in turn were supporting about another 5 or 6 million, you know, family members and friends and so forth. So that was all cut off as of last August. So suddenly, you know, it was like such a cruel thing to do. I mean, it was a deliberate, basically it was to starve the Yemeni middle class is what what that did.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how thorough is the blockade, and what degree of American participation? Is it really the U.S. Navy that makes this blockade work?
Well, it's part. No, it's there. I have to be honest about it. It's, you know, it's the Saudi Navy and the Emirates, you know, United Arab Emirates, which doesn't get mentioned as much as it should because they've been a very active participant in this war. And they were indeed, you know, a component of that SEAL raid we were talking about earlier. So they're doing it, but you know, they're backed up by the Americans, and then that may get more intense because we haven't discussed this, but General Mattis, who was generally lauded in the press as this sort of sober moderate, the one sensible fellow in the Trump administration amid all these fanatical lunatics and you know, bankers that, you know, the liberal press and so forth, you know, they put their faith in Mattis. Well, Mattis is completely insane on the subject of Iran. And he sees, contrary to all evidence, and, you know, like that fellow person you interviewed, you know, that who pointed out that the Houthis are not Hezbollah, Mattis is definitely completely convinced that, and I didn't think it's a show. I've talked to people who've talked to him about it, and he has it really in his head that Iran is, you know, advancing everywhere, and the whole business in Yemen, the Houthis are direct agents of Iran and are, you know, basically just an extension of the Iranians. And therefore, you know, in January or February, not, he had actually came quite close to boarding an Iranian ship in the Red Sea in the conviction that this was, you know, that this was carrying arms for the Houthis, and he had every right to do so. Well, that's an act of war. I mean, does this lunatic really want war with Iran? I think he does. I think he does.
Yeah. And he's the one they're all looking up to. And he's the guy who the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff both used to work for him. And I don't know what his relationship is with McMaster, but these guys, when he was the head of CENTCOM, they were his underlings in the Marines. So.
Yeah, exactly. The Marines and the Army. And they all, I'm told that these, you know, generals that we have.
Oh, yeah, I guess that you're right. You know, that means McMaster was his subordinate, even though he was in the Army. Mattis was the head of CENTCOM when McMaster's still Mr. Big Shot under him in Afghanistan and so forth, too. So there you go.
Right.
All of them used to work for McMaster. I mean, for Mattis before Trump.
Yeah. And they all, I mean, I'm told that all these generals, they all, particularly Mattis, Kelly, Dunford, and what's he called? Leopold, Kellogg, the deputy chief of staff of the National Security Agency and McMaster, they like talk a lot, but obviously they form a block. I mean, they talk to each other all the time. They coordinate their statements and so forth. So we have a sort of we're ruled by, at least in part, by this military junta.
Yeah.
Kind of pretty amazing when you think about it.
Well, I'm trying to do my silver linings. At least it's not Hillary. At least it's not Flynn. At least it's not worse. Sort of could be. I guess. These are severe rationalizations, as Bill Hicks would say, but I'm trying.
Well, you know, what my brother Alexander used to say was, if you go for the lesser of two evils, you end up with both.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So now as far as the famine goes, you know, when they report the casualties, the UN, I guess, has the final say, and they say 10,000 people have been killed. And maybe they'd mean directly, but also, you know, there's this journalist, Nasser Arabi, who I've talked to, who he says, no, 50,000 people have been killed. And he's been doing his, you know, best journalism he can to count them up himself. And that he confronted the UN about it. And they said, oh, yeah, no, you're right. Hey, no argument here. I mean, our ability to nail this down is severely limited under the circumstances. And then, of course, there's the definition of killed, right? Because if you're talking about just an entire population that was already the poorest Arab country to start off with under these circumstances, then you're just having babies stillborn at much higher rates than ever before. You're having people die on the way to the hospital not open and this kind of thing. And that doesn't usually get counted as a combat death, but it gets counted maybe later as an excess death from the time of the war when they compare the death rates later and that kind of deal. Yeah. So I don't know exactly how you count it, but
I mean, the UN, to be sure, the UN, I talked to them, I mean, they get their figures from the WHO, and they get their figures from the hospitals. But what's not being counted is the, you know, the people who don't make it to hospital. And half of those, well, this is the wounded, but also, but you can stay, you can extrapolate that to the dead. You know, over half of the hospitals are in Yemen are out of action. I mean, the UN people, when I was doing that article last year, I talked to them and they said, quite openly, they said, well, really, no one has the faintest idea how many people have been killed or wounded. You know, the you know, they said they were saying 10,000. I mean, last summer, maybe, you know, that was like a round number. So, you know, it's many times that. And that's combat deaths. The 10,000 always was combat deaths. And as you say, that doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't apply to the war-induced civilian casualties.
Well, and then I guess, as has been emphasized by you and by others for 2 years now and then some, about this war, that this is not just the poorest country in the Middle East, but they are almost wholly dependent, or at least they were before. People said, you know, the organization said 80 to 90% dependent on imports for their food. And
yeah,
I had this expert, Martha Mundy, on the show, who explained that a big part of that was because the IMF had come and arranged a deal where, instead of planting sorghum that you guys can harvest and use and is easy and whatever, you should replace those crops with, I forgot what it was, if it was corn or some other crap for sale.
That's right. It was corn. It was and coffee. They wanted to buy coffee. And they
So welcome to the global marketplace, but now you can't feed yourselves when we put a blockade on you. I mean, then the idea is that we don't know, but it could be really high numbers of people who've starved to death here.
Yeah. I mean, it's
already. I mean, it's 2 years into it now, Andrew, right? I mean, so.
Yeah.
Is there a number? Do I overestimate the degree of the shutdown of international trade, or there's a total shutdown of international trade, or it's just the Red Cross has some food aid, or how's this working?
Well, the UN, last year, the UN, there was a sort of uptick. The UN was getting a lot of things improved for a while last year. But since then, it's gone sharply down, partly because the Saudis are, you know, they're holding, you know, the port, I mean, we've mentioned it a couple of times. I mean, the main port is Hodeidah for the Houthi side. And the Saudis very carefully destroyed all the cranes at the port. So you couldn't unload containers anymore. You know, makes it very hard to, very slow to unload shipments. It was quite a modern, you know, relatively speaking, modern port before. So that alone has had a sort of phenomenal effect on the degree. And the Saudis just recently have stepped up their interception of food aid ships and are holding them for days and diverting them to, one of the things they're doing is making them go to Saudi controlled or, you know, Saudi supported forces controlled ports like Aden and so where they can then, you know, they control the food and can control the degree at which it gets shipped into Houthi controlled areas.
So Andrew, you know, just to finish up here, it's worth pointing out, I guess, that Obama had his people tell the New York Times the only reason they were doing this was just to basically make the Saudis feel better, in their words, to placate the Saudis after doing the Iran nuclear deal. Otherwise, the Americans have no interest really in fighting a war against the Houthis, other than, as you said, Mattis's fantasies about Iranian power here that aren't even really true.
Right. And of course, the money, you know, let's people in Washington always try not to talk about money. You know, that this is hugely problematic. You know, as I said in the article, we have this 1,000 or basically 2,000 person base in outside Riyadh, who are there, they're training and advising, but their main job, it's in their mission statement, you can look it up on their website, is to sell U.S. defense equipment. So this is, you know, this is great for business.
By the way, did you ever nail down the rumor, as you put it, the single unconfirmed source that you had that said that American flyers maybe active duty, maybe contractors, were actually riding in the back seats of these F-15s helping the Saudis bomb these people?
I never did. You reminded me. I should have another effort.
Yeah. And, you know, because I had another rumor that of the same thing, too. But anyway, yeah, I'll let you go. Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it.
All right, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's Andrew Coburn. He wrote Kill Chain about Obama's drone war. And this one is Acceptable Losses in Harper's. It's one of the best ones. Obviously, you can tell the background of what's going on with the American war against and for all sides in Yemen. All right, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org, at libertarianinstitute.org, and follow me on Twitter. Sorry if I insult you. At Scott Horton Show. Thanks. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
You drink coffee, I drink coffee, just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.